From theunce.com, this is the Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Hello and welcome to the Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. For this inaugural episode of 2011, we've got something special for you. Unce correspondent Natty Morrison got a chance to interview superstar Brian Transeau, better known as BT. A vanguard in the industry for nearly two decades, Transeau's latest album, These Hopeful Machines, has been nominated for a Grammy in the Best Electronic Dance category. Let's get to the interview.
You've been quoted as saying that you're not a DJ. Do you think you could elaborate on this at all? What separates you from DJs? Would you consider yourself a DJ in any respect?
Okay, so just in thinking about this, I just kind of opened Google here, and I think we should start with an etymology of the word DJ. Uh-huh. So DJ is a word that, you know, everybody knows. It's common knowledge is an acronym for disc jockey. And here on Wikipedia, it says, disc jockey, also known as DJ, is a person who selects and plays recorded music for an audience. Originally, disc referred to phonograph records, while disc referred to compact disc, and it has become a more common spelling.
Yeah.
Today, the term includes all forms of music playback, no matter the source. This I find very interesting. So I think for the traditional meaning of the word DJ or disc jockey falls so far outside of what I do when I'm performing live. First of all, there's two permutations of live performance that I do. One is fully live with a live band. We play everything live. Everybody's multi-instrumentalist. It's usually between a four and six-piece band. Like we did This Binary Universe is a four-piece band. And I played a circuit bent lap dulcimer. I played bass. I played acoustic guitar and sang on Satellite. I played the Glockenspiel and I played keyboard synthesizers. Ben Grossman played a 14th century Armenian instrument called the Vielaru. He played the Udu and he also played Glockenspiel. And then Brian Trifon played acoustic and electric guitars through all kinds of, you know, circuit bent pedals and outboard gear and stuff. So that permutation of my live show, we do completely live. I sing, I play a bunch of different instruments, as does everyone in my band. I've got amazing musicians in my band. And then when I'm doing a laptop show, I use Ableton Live and I use a bunch of proprietary audio software that I created for my company, Sonic Architects, which has now been acquired by iZotope. So I've been using this software and alpha testing it really for years and years. And then I use small loops and fragments of both my music and other people's music. And I take these things and recontextualize them in such a way as to create something that, for all intents and purposes, many times just didn't exist before I walked into the booth or on stage. So it's as unrelated to mixing two records together as I can't even, there's not like, it's completely unrelated. Now, all of that being said, I have an incredible, tremendous amount of affinity and admiration for DJing, traditional DJing and DJing culture. My favorite DJ ever and always will be is Sasha. Watching him take two pieces of vinyl and a simple mixer and mixing together two records and keeping things, you know, tonally and spectrally related for hours and hours is such a tremendous art form. It's not one that I'm adept at. What I do is completely different. I'm doing live remixing and mashups of music. And oftentimes I'm writing things too. I'll write a bass line, I'll write an acid part, and I'll mix it in with, you know, a beat that I create on stage. So it's really more like, you know, it's live electronic music mashup and remixing. So, and that's why we called it Laptop Symphony, because there's just wasn't really a name for it. It really isn't DJing.
Well, you've also said that you're, quote, more of an explorer than a composer. Even though you certainly have a composer's training, you studied both at WCM and at Berkeley. So does your knowledge of music theory and composition help you in your search for new sounds? Or does it ever inhibit your explorations?
I'll answer the second question first. It never, ever inhibits my explorations. In fact, it's a tremendous resource of information that keeps me, you know, stretching and reaching and learning all the time. You know, one of my favorite, you know, composers is John Cage. And, you know, I love the pieces that he did where he hooked gel electrodes to plants and recorded, you know, various things going on electrochemically with plants. And that so inspired me that for years and years, I've looked for a way to do that myself. And recently I found a device that will record the neural activity of insects. And I've just ordered it, and as an audio stream too. So he's a classical composer. We'd consider him a modern, you know, 20th century classical composer. And so I'm always finding these bits of, you know, resources from things I studied as a kid that continue to inform my work to this day. So it really doesn't ever inhibit my explorations. I understand the question though, in that, you know, once you have this kind of like dogmatic formal training, what happens then? Like, do you just fit your things in a box and that's kind of the place that you write from? And I'd say more than anything, that really never happens. I mean, when I was in music school, sure, it's like you're always thinking about, you know, what's happening in a piece melodically and harmonically, and you're doing, you know, tonal and harmonic analysis of pieces as you're listening to them in real time, and you start to notice all the similarities in music, and that kind of cabbages your head for a while. But once that's gone, the traces and the remnants, the wonderful things that it leaves you with, like, you know, just learning how to write contrapuntally and thinking outside of using the root in the bass, you know, using thirds and fifths in the bass. These are things that, you know, have deeply, deeply informed my work and continue to inspire me to this day.
Stormy clouds will pass over me, and the fear I hold inside will be no longer.
You got your first taste of success back in the early 90s when, unbeknownst to you, UK heavy hitters like Paul Oakenfold started spinning your records live. What was it like to wake up in Maryland and find out that you were a star in England?
It was crazy. I was living in my bedroom at my parents' house. And honestly, I didn't believe that until I went there. And I went to a party that was in a barn in Farnham. And I watched Sasha play Loving You More at the end of the night on a dance floor in a barn where they'd literally moved the farm animals out. And people literally with their arms in the air and screaming and literally people crying. It was unbelievable still to this day. It's a story I've told many times, but interestingly, I just wrote a blog about this. I should send it to you too.
Okay. Do you think the UK was more receptive to your music than the US?
Most definitely. I mean, England in many ways will always be my musical home because they just got it. You know, I was in Los Angeles for a period of time before I moved back to Maryland to my parents' house, trying to get a record deal. And everybody was like, well, you know, what are these 10-minute long compositions, you know, that follow ABA or ABCA form and are primarily instrumental and like, you know, are dense harmonically and like, what the hell are they? You know, no one was interested at all. You know, A&R guys would laugh when I would play them these things. And so to go to England and to see people not only get it, but to move their bodies to it and to embrace it culturally was just, it was and still is just, you know, a tremendous honor.
You're often, you know, referred to as being a key figure in the creation of trance as a genre. When you were putting out some of those first trance records, do you recall thinking to yourself, you know, I'm creating something totally new?
No, I didn't think that. But also, too, I didn't know what was going on. And so now in retrospect, I realize how new it was, this idea of non-linearity in, I didn't even know what house music was at that time, but the dynamics, the use of builds and breakdowns, and the intricacy of harmony in those tracks were sort of these voices that just weren't around then. And then, of course, other people began doing that and it turned into a thing. And I think it shows more than anything that kind of naivety in ways, you know, can help you to crack through new things, you know, like break a barrier that isn't even a perceived barrier. You didn't even know what was there. So they're just really genuine. And, you know, what I was feeling at the time and what was kind of on my heart to write.
Looking back on trance as a genre, how would you say the style has changed throughout the years?
Well, I think for a long period of time, it came extremely formulaic. And that's sort of when I had bowed out of it and really went full-fledged into something that also, too, was very new at the time, the break scene. You know, when it just became a bunch of like 16th note snare fills and, you know, a cheesy little top line and, you know, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down sort of thing, I lost interest in it. But I think, you know, over the last 5 to 6 years, trance has really gotten amazing. The productions that people are doing, like the Above and Beyond guys and Marcus Schissau and Marco V and, you know, Andrew Baer. I mean, some of the productions that people are doing are just so intricate and, you know, sonically delightful. So it's gotten really, really good over the past couple of years, which is pretty neat. It's made me interested in it in some ways again.
Do you feel that through its many permutations and mutations over the years, trance still represents that same aesthetic that you and your colleagues established in the 90s?
I think in some ways it's kind of come full circle, and that's something I'm very proud of.
Okay. You've collaborated with a plethora of artists spanning nearly every genre. What attracts you most to collaboration? Is your writing process and collaboration different than with independent production?
What attracts me most to collaboration is, first, somebody that I can break bread with. And I mean that, and it sounds weird, but I really, really mean it, especially when it comes to things like film scores. I've had some crazy experiences in that arena. I just work with people that I know and I like. And that's kind of my own personal rule for working with people, first. And secondly, I work with people whose work that I love, and I let them do what they do, and I do what I do, and that seems to work out. So that's kind of the bar.
Who are some of your favorite artists that you've collaborated with? Is there anybody that you would really like to team up with in the future?
Some of my favorite artists I've collaborated with are Peter Gabriel, was one of the most tremendous experiences of my entire life, was and still is. And my early collaborations with Sasha were just tremendous, tremendous experiences. And I think recently, some of my favorite collaborations have been with Jess and Christian Burns. We've just written some stuff that I'm extremely, extremely proud of. So in the future, some people that I've always wanted to work with, I'm going to throw these two names out there again, are Missy E and the Chronos String Quartet. I'd love to do some stuff with Skrillex. I love what he's doing. I love Rusko's stuff as well. And I've got some stuff going with Tidy that's just freaking mental. So he's someone who I've watched for quite a while now. So yeah, that's a few.
From a listener's standpoint, These Hopeful Machines, your new album, sounds like a return to dance music after exploring soundscapes and ambience in this binary universe. What inspired you to dig back into your dance music roots?
Thank you for saying that. You know what? I missed it. And I found myself interested in club culture for the first time in years and years. And I started to hear things and sounds and productions that I found inspiring. And it sent me into a hole with a guitar and drum machines and Xcode. And I came back out with this album. And so I just felt inspired by dance music culture for the first time in years.
It sounds like you retained some of the glitch that listeners found in Universe. What draws you to that glitch sound? Is it related to the use of your stutter edit?
Interestingly, I find that aesthetic really pleasing. I love those kind of really small, you know, single, double, triple cycle, unipolar, clicky type sounds. And, you know, a great portion of my work is exploring this kind of microrhythmic realm, you know, both in rhythm and in granular and, you know, granular timbres and in granular synthesis, and exploring, you know, what is right at the cusp between rhythm and pitch, you know, which would be, you know, rhythm, you know, becomes expressed as pitch at 20 hertz. Once something is repeating, once something's repetition rate is quicker than 20 hertz, it discontinues being expressed as rhythm and begins to be expressed as pitch.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's in this area between like 12 and 20 hertz that really, really fascinates me, where the human brain, kind of on a cognitive level, the perceptual level, we don't know how to interpret that kind of rhythmic stimuli. And so I think some of my favorite, you know, explorations are in that arena.
What led you to choose the psychedelic first tune, The Ghost in You, to cover on this album?
Well, it's one of my favorite songs as a kid. It has incredible personal meaning to me. It reminds me of clunking around in black combat boots and black eyeliner with a mohawk with my best friends, Ali from Deep Dish, and my friend Hamid, that's an organic chemist that lives in San Fran now. And reminds me of the three of us clunking around and listening to Depeche Mode and Psychedelic Furs records and trying to be goth, I guess. But it really was this incredible sort of, you know, music to my little coming of age in a small town in suburban Maryland. And so it just holds a tremendous amount of personal importance to me. And so when I covered that song, I wanted to sort of to share what it felt like to me, not what the song sounded like, if that makes sense. And so that really was how that cover came about.
While you do utilize guest vocalists in your music, you're also not afraid to show off your own voice. What influences you when you're deciding whether, you know, to sing it yourself or to ask someone else to give it a shot?
More than anything, it's like how personal the lyric is. You know, sometimes it just seems more appropriate for someone to sing it other than me, and other times it just feels right to sing the lead myself, or like with Every Other Way, it's like kind of like a duet. It just depends on the song and how I hear it in my head too. Sometimes I just hear myself singing it, other times I hear other people.
So you initially chose to release Machines as 2-hour-long tracks online. You said it was an attempt to sort of bring listeners back to the album experience. You know, for you, what do you think is so special about experiencing an album from front to back? Do you think that listeners today digest music differently, like with singles as opposed to full-length records?
Well, for sure. Again, to answer your second question first, nobody listens to albums anymore. Everybody listens to their iPod on shuffle. And yeah, my greatest memories of being a kid were riding my bike to Yesterday and Today Records, picking up, let's say, the Soul Mining or New Order Low Life, ride my bike back to the house, taking out the vinyl, putting it on my turntable, calling Ali and Hamid, getting them to come over to the house, and sitting there for 2 hours and reading the liner notes and listening to the album twice. Those are literally some of the greatest memories of being a kid for me. And I think that experience is completely lost on people now. And we listen to music as a periphery. You know, in our society now, we're so forced to be divergent, you know, we're all social mediaed out and, you know, stretched thin as at work and in our personal lives. And nobody sits down to just listen to music anymore. And I write these records wanting that, you know. It's something I ask of my end user, is to give it attention. And, you know, you can like it or not like it, but if you're interested in it, to really sit down and give it your full attention. Because I think there are a lot of people like me too. The real kind of beauty and mindfulness and intricacy comes from like actual attentive listening. And so, you know, I put thousands of hours of thought into this album and thousands of hours more work. And so I wanted to ask people to embrace it as a unified body of work. And people that did that, which by the way, it was like most people unanimously loved that format. And I think I'll do it again because the reaction was so overwhelmingly positive. It really was heartwarming to me because it made me feel like, wow, people still can give an hour and a half or 2 hours of their life to something and take away something meaningful and personal to them. So that was exciting and rewarding.
You know, so what was your reaction when you found out that these Hopeful Machines had gotten the Grammy nomination?
First, I burst into tears, and then I high-fived random strangers, and then I burst into tears again, and then high-fived more random strangers. And all of this, by the way, happened in an airport. It was the most profound professional experience of my entire life. Nothing has ever had more meaning to me professionally than that moment. I have tremendous significance and meaning attached because of what it meant to me as a kid.
You've been making music for nearly 2 decades at this point. What do you think 1994 Brian Tranzo would say to 2011 Brian Tranzo?
I think he'd say, way to fucking go, man.
Okay. Hey, man, thanks for being on the UNS podcast.
Cool. I really appreciate the interview. These were really thoughtful questions. Thanks for your time. Take it easy.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's UNS podcast. Special thanks go to UNS correspondent Natty Morrison, Emily Tan of Emily Tan Media Relations and Artist Management, and of course, Brian Tranzo. As part of a special Grammy giveaway, we've got autographed copies of BT's Grammy-nominated album, These Hopeful Machines, for 2 lucky fans. Please visit theUNS.com for all the contest details. Coming up next week on the UNS podcast, indie oddball Nick Koenig will be my guest. Under the moniker Hot Sugar, Koenig is releasing his debut EP Muscle Milk, featuring his bizarre samples and musical sensibilities. Remember to visit theUNS.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review. Tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, or you'd like to be a guest on the UNS podcast, contact me at anand@theUNS.com. That's ANAND @theUNS.com. Catch you next week.